Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Durham gets 2-for-1 job creation deal. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Durham, and the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far right, there's a picture of a man casually dressed, just him leaning against a wall. The caption reads, Dr. Don Brown relocated to the Triangle to cash in on the IT talent his company needs. When OrgSpan founder Jeff Schwartz was looking for software engineers to help him launch a company near his home in Middle Tennessee, he found he had to expand his network base all the way to the Triangle to find the talent he needed. So he moved his startup to Durham in early 2012. There's lots of good software developers in the Triangle, says Schwartz, who has since hired 20 people for his company. That, in turn, caught the attention of OrgSpan's largest financial backer, Dr. Don Brown, who also is president and CEO of one of the leading software developers for the call center industry, Indianapolis-based Interactive Intelligence Group. Don saw the luck I was having here and decided to tap into that talent as well, Schwartz says. Brown opened an office here for his company. Now both OrgSpan and Interactive Intelligence are expanding their shared office space in a Durham office building. They will collectively create about 30 software development, engineering, and sales jobs by the end of 2013, in addition to the 30 people the two companies already employ in Durham. Observers say the two companies could employ 100 people within the next 2 years. The average pay for both the Interactive Intelligence and the OrgSpan jobs will be between $80,000 and $120,000 a year, depending on the applicant's skills and experience. Schwartz worked for Brown for 16 years at Interactive Intelligence and at Brown's first company, Software Artistry, which was subsequently acquired by IBM before launching OrgSpan. He says Interactive Intelligence has always struggled to find enough software developers living in the Indianapolis area or people willing to move to the city. As a result, the company has opened multiple development offices around the country, including in Jacksonville, Florida, where the company's Latitude Software subsidiary is based, and in Herndon, Virginia, where its Eastern Regional Headquarters is located. But the company had never ventured into the Triangle before. Steve Head, Chief Financial Officer of Interactive Intelligence, says the Durham team will be working on the company's newest platform for contact center solutions, utilizing some of the newest technology, namely programs developed for cloud-based services. He expects the company will have a staff of 30 people before the end of the year. It is currently taking applications for 5 positions in Durham, including for quality assurance engineers, software developers, and web developers. While OrgSpan is focused on the official product launch on March 4 of its first application, an employee directory search tool for companies with 500 employees or more, Interactive Intelligence has been a market leader since its inception in 1994. It's built a base of about 5,000 customers worldwide, including Motorola, U.S. Airways, Sony, and Harvard University. Its stock has been publicly traded on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange since 1999. The company reported sales of $237 million in its last annual filing, but its profit margin was razor thin last year primarily because of deferral of revenues that included costs in the current year. Currently, the stock trades in the $40 range. Head says the company is growing everywhere, noting that Interactive Intelligence's staff in the U.S. grew by about 400 in 2012. Both companies will be relocating in April to a 27,000-square-foot top-floor space in the Yorkshire Place office building in the Imperial Center Business Park in Durham, says Mac Hammer, a real estate broker with Synergy Commercial Advisors in Morrisville. He, along with Synergy partner Rich Harris, represented OrgSpan and Interactive Intelligence in its lease negotiations. Clay Stober with Tri Properties in Durham represented the landlord in the deal. Stober says the companies will be backfilling space that Novella Clinical recently vacated in the building when it moved to Perimeter Park in Morrisville. And as we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we have the cover story for this issue, and it's inside of a black box. There are two articles inside the box. First, the article that takes up most of this box has a picture at the top of people sitting at the airport. And then in bold white lettering over the picture is the headline, "The New American." And then under that, the subheadline, "Competitor seen keeping merged carrier in check at RDU." And then under that is the article written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Morrisville. While a merged American Airlines, U.S. Airways would have robust market power, the new American is not expected to be a bully at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, thanks to strong competition and only one overlapping route. The major competitors facing the new American Airlines at RDU would be Southwest Airlines and Delta Airlines. As for that sole redundant route, it's to Reagan National Airport just south of Washington, D.C. Bob Herps, a St. Louis consultant who runs AirlineFinancials.com, says competition would keep a bigger American from flexing any pricing muscle. They want to take passengers away from Delta, United, and Southwest, and I don't think they're going to raise airfares to do that, Herps says. I see higher fares coming, but it doesn't have anything to do with mergers. Airlines have cut capacity for the last 15 months or so in order to stamp out discounting and push up averaging fares. From a national perspective, people in the travel industry say business travelers may actually benefit from the merger. One reason is that the merged airline will probably continue American's historical outreach to travel agents and corporate travel managers, says Eddie Albertson, vice president of sales and marketing at Travel Management Partners in Raleigh. While U.S. Air has improved its corporate travel programs in recent years, its business model has more closely resembled those of Southwest Airlines and other low-cost carriers, Albertson says. Mergers often raise concerns about market power and ensuing higher prices. American and U.S. Air are now the fourth and fifth largest domestic airlines in terms of passenger counts, or, when international flights are included, the third and fourth largest. Once fully merged, the new American could be the world's largest, depending on whether it sheds any flights to allay concerns about excessive market power at four or five particular airports. As for service, people in the industry believe the merger is likely to result in improved service and perks, particularly for customers who now fly with U.S. Air. Herb says he expects the merged airline to keep American's place in the One World Alliance, which also includes British Airways, Japan Airways, and Australia's Qantas. One World's presence at most major international airports is stronger than that of the Star Alliance, which includes U.S. Air, Herp says. Representatives of both American and U.S. Airways have said the merged airline will honor existing frequent flyer miles. For U.S. Air customers, that's likely to mean an ability to transfer miles into the One World network without having to pay the erstwhile fee, Herp says. The new American Airlines is expected to offer members more opportunities to earn and burn miles from an expanded global network of routes and partnerships, American spokesman Matt Miller says. Other perks are also at stake, though. The ability to upgrade from economy class to business class and first class is one. And the two merger partners have declined to make detailed promises on how they'll integrate their rewards programs. Unfortunately, when you put airlines together, somebody's probably not going to get what they used to get, Albertson says. And in this cover story area, there's a second article, also written by Chris Bagley, with the dateline of Morrisville. The headline on this second cover story article, "Terminal 1 renovation coming along to suit Southwest and AirTran." While Southwest Airlines and AirTran Airways are finally starting to coordinate their flights under their common ownership, it appears now that their new digs in Terminal 1 of Raleigh-Durham International Airport may be ready for them nearly a year before their integration is complete. The $68 million renovation of the terminal's central section is moving forward on schedule, RDU officials say, and the target date for reopening has also gotten a bit more precise. Initially forecast for the first quarter of 2014, the reopening is now expected in the February to March time frame, RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says. Work is supposed to wrap up by the end of 2013, leaving a couple of months for testing various systems and making final adjustments. Meanwhile, Southwest is connecting Southwest and AirTran flights under common itineraries only at a handful of selected airports. It aims to combine most other itineraries by mid-summer and have the two airlines fully integrated by the end of 2014. Ultimately, the carriers will fly under a single brand, Southwest. Like American Airlines and U.S. Airways, which are also moving toward a merger, Southwest and AirTran have similar business models and have been seen as running complementary schedules of flights. AirTran flies from RDU to Atlanta, which Southwest doesn't, and it has established toeholds in Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean, which Southwest hasn't. Southwest, for its part, flies a dozen routes from RDU that AirTran doesn't. Also, like American and U.S. Air in Terminal 2, Southwest and AirTran have shared a terminal and will continue to do so. They're now operating out of Terminal 1's northern extension, which may be demolished after the two airlines move into the newer area. Plans for the terminal call for a more open and airy feel, with large windows to let in plenty of light, similar to the recently completed renovation at Terminal 2, and Terminal 1's baggage handling area is being expanded. Airline terminals are generally up for renovation every 20 to 30 years or so. The section now under renovation first opened in 1982. Oh, and that blue exterior will be gone. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Developer Kane, Lawyer Wheeler, Join RDU Board. Raleigh real estate developer John Kane and attorney Clay Wheeler have joined the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority. Kane, the CEO of Kane Realty Corporation, began his term representing Wake County in January, replacing Michael Weeks. Wheeler, a litigator, white-collar criminal defense attorney, and partner with Kilpatrick Townsend in Raleigh, was sworn in February 7 to represent Durham County. He succeeds Craigie Sanders. Wake and Durham counties and the cities of Raleigh and Durham each have two representatives on the eight-member board. Several Triangle entities have snagged top honors in the North Carolina Department of Commerce's 2012 NC Main Street and Small Town Main Street programs. Award winners were recognized for excellence in downtown revitalization in categories that include promotion, organization, design, and economic restructuring. Triangle towns receiving awards in the North Carolina Main Street category were Clayton and Fuquay Varina. Little known fact, Wake Forest had a church before it was a town. In fact, local historians say both the town and Wake Forest University, long since relocated to Winston-Salem, grew up around the 223-year-old Wake Union Baptist Church, whose history was recently celebrated by the Wake Forest Historical Society. We recognize that any community is made up of all of its parts, that we're a fabric of different kinds of people, churches and faiths and backgrounds and different visions, the church's pastor, Al Margarat, told the Wake Weekly. The Chapel Hill Town Council is considering changes to its sign ordinance after receiving a request to do so from the general manager of the Aloft Chapel Hill Hotel. Mark Sherburn notes that Aloft, a hotel brand recognized for an urban hip style of architecture, in Chapel Hill is not being allowed to display its brand on the building as it does in other markets. The Aloft Chapel Hill sign is on the second floor and is in plain white lighting, instead of multiple colors to adhere to the town's sign law. Every Aloft has their signage on the top floor except for Aloft Chapel Hill, Sherburn is quoted in the Daily Tar Heel as saying. It has greatly diminished our visibility. An amendment being considered by the council would allow for roofline signs. TBJ reported in the February 15, 2013 issue that developers are drawing plans for two additional Aloft brand hotels in the Triangle, one adjacent to the Durham Performing Arts Center, and another across from NC State University's Bell Tower on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh. PNC has provided Wake Education Partnership with two grants, totaling $75,000, to help fund the local nonprofit organization's Building Leaders Initiative and early childhood literacy efforts. One grant of $30,000 will focus on improving early childhood literacy skills in Wake County through community outreach events, and the other grant of $45,000 will support the partnership's Business Leaders Initiative. Apparently, frat brothers and sorority sisters want to eat something other than fish sticks and cold pizza. Who knew? Biz came across a company called Campus Cooks that makes its business providing healthy meals prepared by professional chefs for sororities and fraternities across the U.S. And the company has hired Raleigh area resident Shelley Norton as its Southeast Regional Sales Director. She's now charged with expanding CC services to higher education institutions in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, and Tennessee. Currently, the only Triangle client for Campus Cooks is the Kappa Kappa Gamma House at UNC Chapel Hill. Three veteran builders from the Triangle will be inducted into the Hall of Fame of the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County at a ceremony March 7 at the Renaissance Hotel at North Hills in Raleigh. The inductees are Lyle Gardner of Spectrum Homes in Raleigh, Mason Williams of Williams Property Group in Raleigh, and Ray Barker. Among the 13 past inductees into the HBA Hall of Fame are Judd Ammons, Lewis Dickerson, Bob Schultz, Dan Tingen, and Harold Glazer. Michael Jacobs of Chapel Hill is one happy man nowadays. Jacobs, who owns Jacobs Capital in Chapel Hill, is the newest owner of a Tesla Model S, an electrically powered sports car. "The car was delivered in a covered 18-wheeler to my front door," Jacob tells Biz. "I believe mine is the first in Chapel Hill." Jacob says he first heard of the Tesla when a Wall Street Journal editor spoke at Kenan Flagler Business School about a year ago. "I put down a deposit and became about number 5,000 on the wait list 8 months ago," Jacobs recalls. "The concept of never having to buy gas again appealed to me." For that to happen, Jacobs dropped a pretty penny for the car. The Tesla Model S has an average price of about $100,000 and can travel about 300 miles on a single charge, depending on the battery strength. Jobs, jobs, jobs. It's a news trend Biz likes seeing, with announcements this week that United Healthcare will be adding 600 North Carolina jobs, and Silicon Valley firm Nimble Storage is adding 100 to a new RTP operation. And here's something new. In a chat with the folks at NetApp, Biz learns that the headcount in the Triangle now stands at 1,606, up from 1,500 in October, and the company's still hiring. Durham entrepreneur Aaron Houghton has reached a milestone with his company, Boost Suite. 6 months after launching Boost Suite's do-it-yourself web marketing tool, the company confirms 5,000 users. Globally, there are over 18 million small businesses that each have annual marketing budgets of $3,000 or less, Houghton says, and that's his audience. Boost Suite was featured by Inc. magazine in January as the first of three easy SEO tools to improve a website. Contributing to Biz were Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Lauren Onsorge, Chris Bagley, Cameron Snipes, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to has the headline, "Worries Bubble Over Commission Remakes." And this article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. "A legislative proposal to remake several regulatory boards could create dysfunction at the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which oversees the electricity and gas industries," several people in the industry say. Senate Bill 10 would dismiss the six members now on the seven-seat utility commission and allow Governor Pat McCrory to appoint all new members. Most of the boards now have staggered terms without the legislation. McCrory could replace Utilities Commission Chairman Ed Finley and Commissioners Lucy Allen and William Culpepper in July 2013, and at least one other commissioner in 2015. Replacing the board's entire membership would set back its timetable for several regulatory decisions that energy companies need before they can make business decisions, says John Morrison, Director of Government Affairs for Chapel Hill-based Strata Solar, the state's largest solar developer. For solar companies, that could mean several extra weeks of uncertainty over a key rate that investors insist on knowing before putting money into large solar farms. "It will put a big hole in our schedule," Morrison says. The sheer complexity of utilities regulation is reason enough not to bring in too many neophytes at once, says Scott Hempling, a Washington, D.C. area utilities attorney who has been a witness for North Carolina's utility consumer advocate in proceedings here. Replacing the entire commission at once would eliminate a lot of institutional knowledge, he says. This is exceedingly rare and troublesome, Hempling says. The job of regulators is to ensure excellent performance by billion-dollar companies. Everybody on Wall Street who cares about utilities is looking at your situation and going, what's up? Senator Bill Rabin, Republican from Brunswick, says the bill would allow appointees to, quote, carry out the philosophy of the new administration, unquote. McCrory has said he aims to emphasize a customer service attitude in state government and promote economic growth. The bill cleared the Senate on February 7 and passed an initial vote in the House of Representatives on February 12. McCrory hasn't indicated how he would fill the Utility Commission's 7 seats and has even said that the bill took him by surprise. Hempling says it's conceivable that the governor could simply reappoint some or all of the dismissed members. McCrory could reach into the small pool of regulatory attorneys who now practice before the commission, as Democratic Governor Mike Easley did in appointing Finley in 2007. Utilities attorneys declined to comment on the record about appointments that could affect their clients' businesses' interests. One notes that other commissioners had less familiarity with utilities than Finley, who had been a partner with Hunton and Williams. Allen was mayor of Lewisburg, which operates its own electrical utility, in partnership with several other North Carolina municipalities. But the commission also includes at least one former litigator and a former political advisor to former Governor Beverly Perdue. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Venture Rising, Fund Aims to Cuddle into Startup Scene in Durham. Two veteran Raleigh venture capitalists have launched an effort to raise $25 million for a new seed stage venture fund that would collaborate with business startup activities in Durham. David Jones and Jason Kaplan, partners in Raleigh-based Southern Capital Ventures, are offering shares in Bull City Ventures 3, according to documents filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. In a late January filing, which puts the fund's target at the $25 million mark, the men listed the number of investors at zero, saying the first sale in the offering has yet to occur. Repeated attempts to reach both Jones and Kaplan for comment were not successful. Even so, their latest effort is well known in the area's VC community. They're out there trying, says CED Director Joan Rose when asked about the Bull City fundraiser, like a lot of others. Kaplan is co-founder of Southern Capital, which opened its doors in 2000 and raised its most recent fund, its second, with a target of between $12 million and $15 million back in 2006. Jones, a UNC Chapel Hill MBA, joined the company after working with accounting firm Deloitte. Southern Capital has a portfolio of 15 companies in which it has invested, including Motricity and Synthematics. Those two companies, plus three others on the list, have either been acquired by other firms or have gone public. Southern Capital founding partner Ben Brooks says Southern has room to make at least one more investment from its second fund, and after that will determine when the time is right to move beyond its fund two. Not involved in the Bull City effort, he had no comment. One of Southern Capital's investors has been the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, which, according to documents, committed $71,250 into two SCV funds between 2001 and 2005. SCV is known to have connections to two of Durham's recently established tech incubators and accelerators, Triangle Startup Factory and Groundwork Lab, both located in the American Underground Complex. Both organizations vet seed stage startups. Another recent entry into that field, a 60-day business accelerator called Bull City Stampede, isn't involved in the new venture fund, says Stampede co-founder Adam Klein. Though the need for a seed stage capital in Durham and elsewhere is great, finding investors willing to commit dollars in the field hasn't been easy in recent quarters. In 2011, according to the Silicon Valley Watcher, seed stage investing declined nationally by 48%. The numbers for 2012 are being tabulated. Seed stage has been a challenge, says Greg Bolin, director of Chapel Hill-based Morgan Creek Ventures. A lot of investors have been staying away. And we have one more article on this page, also written by Lee Weisbecker. The headline, More Oversight for Nonprofits, Mission of Bill. After tightening the financial reporting rules governing state-supported nonprofits last year, lawmakers are at it again with another oversight proposal. This time, they want to know whether the state is getting a bang for its buck when it spends roughly $600 million a year to support hundreds of nonprofit organizations. A bipartisan group of 8 House Democrats and 29 House Republicans, members of a legislative program evaluation committee, have affixed their names to a bill that would require state-supported nonprofits to draw up measurable benchmarks or program goals and then supply quantifiable data on whether they've been met. It would be up to the various state departments and agencies that make the grants to monitor whether the goals are being met. And to assist in the oversight, the bill allows agencies to deduct up to 2% of a grant award to offset higher administrative costs. On $600 million, for example, in a rough calculation, maximum deductions would be $12 million. Nonprofits aren't warming up to that part of the plan. We don't believe a tax on nonprofits to fund this is the best approach, says David Heinen of the Raleigh-based North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. He hastens to add, however, that nonprofits don't mind setting specific program goals and reporting on results, the crux of the new proposal. It's in line with what many are already doing, he says. Last year, lawmakers passed a bill requiring nonprofits receiving grants larger than $5,000 to provide annual financial statements and copies of their IRS 990 tax forms to any requesting member of the public. That's on top of prior auditing requirements. Under those rules, outside groups receiving large state grants are required to submit annual independent audits for state inspections, says Bill Holmes of the North Carolina Office of the State Auditor, run by Beth Wood. Nonprofits receiving lesser amounts submit spending summaries. Organizations not following those reporting requirements face a cutoff of funds. What makes the new bill in the General Assembly different is that it moves oversight efforts away from strictly financial factors and puts a greater emphasis on whether the nonprofits are running effective programs. One of its sponsors, Jacksonville Republican George Cleveland, believes the bill has a good chance of making it through this session. There are a lot of those groups receiving state money that get little oversight, he says, and I believe if taxpayer money is going out to them, we ought to know how they are performing. Bill would force railroad to hand over millions to state. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. A bill filed in the General Assembly would require the Raleigh-based North Carolina Railroad Company to pay millions of dollars in dividends to the state, sell off more than a dozen former depot lots, and submit more detailed financial reports on its operations. The legislative move follows a critical report by a General Assembly Oversight Division that the state-owned NCRR hasn't been paying its one and only stockholder, state government, any returns in recent years. Insiders say lawmakers want to use the dividend payments to fund economic development projects. Under the measure filed by Concord Republican Fletcher Hartzell, NCRR would pay a one-time dividend of $15.5 million, make annual payments of nearly $4 million, and relinquish the parcels of land it owns. The land would be transferred to the Department of Administration, which would sell it. In the Triangle, the property includes a 3-acre lot in Hillsboro, an acreage in Morrisville that was once a train depot site. The 163-year-old NCRR owns a 317-mile rail corridor between Morehead City and Charlotte and leases freight-carrying rights on the line to Norfolk Southern. In return, it receives about $14 million a year from Norfolk Southern, an amount that makes up about 70% of its total revenue. NCRR spokeswoman Terry Saylor says the agency has been following the progress of the Hartzell bill, which has passed its first reading in the Senate and been referred to the Program Evaluation Committee. Railroad President Scott Saylor, who is no relation to Terry Saylor, adds that despite the bill and its possible outcomes, We'll continue to do our job and to identify needs associated with the line and meet them. NCRR has identified $103 million in capital needs for its system, he says. In addition to the financial changes, Hartzell's draft would require NRCC to submit more detailed annual financial reports. While NCRR has been submitting statements to a legislative committee since 2007, the examiners from the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division said in their critical report that the corporation hasn't been including information on such topics as leases, acquisitions, or sales of real property or lawsuits pending. Beefed up reporting requirements are seen as the solution. While not all 10K requirements would be applicable to NCRR, many of the requirements would provide the state with more information for oversight of NCRR, according to John W. Turcotte, Director of the Evaluation Division. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And we start first with the column by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, Conservationists Massing Forces to Fend Off Opposition to Causes. The Colbert Report on Comedy Central, in a 2012 episode, lampooned a bill introduced by a North Carolina state lawmaker to bar the Coastal Resources Commission from defining rates of sea level changes for regulatory purposes. The bill, as originally introduced, was written in a way that seemed to indicate the legislature was mandating that the oceans not rise, says Brian Busby, executive director of the Raleigh-based North Carolina Conservation Network. They scaled back the bill, but they essentially put their heads in the sand. The bill and the national publicity helped drive a surge in subscriptions from 14,000 to 25,000 to a weekly email public alert from Conservation Network. The number of the network's Facebook friends rose as well, from 4,000 to 10,000. Now, seeing serious threats to the environment and environmental policy in the areas of air quality and energy, water quality and quantity, and land conservation and open space, the Conservation Network is expanding its staff to strengthen its community organizing and communications. Policy decisions are taking the last 3 to 4 decades of a very balanced approach of environmental protection and economic development and throwing that out the window, Busby says. Formed in 1998 and operating with an annual budget of $800,000 and a staff of 8 people, the Conservation Network serves nearly 100 affiliate environmental groups throughout the state. It communicates with its member groups every day by email and phone and in person, distributes a weekly email message to its 25,000 activist subscribers on a current topic on which they can act, and posts daily Facebook updates on its campaigns it's waging on issues inviting people to get involved. The network's use of social media includes raising awareness about new studies and breaking news about the environment, as well as celebrating North Carolina's environment. And an online auction, which raised $20,000 last fall, has grown by inviting affiliates and activists to donate items, such as the use of their beach houses or their business services. An approach that Busby says not only generates more revenue, but also helps the network better engage and know its supporters. With the environment facing critical challenges, he says, the role of advocacy has become increasingly important. A report last year by the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association estimated conservatively that the state is home to more than 15,200 clean energy jobs at 1,100 companies in 86 of the state's 100 counties, with those companies generating over $3.7 billion in annual revenue. North Carolina has had a long history of working hard and working together to balance environmental protection with a strong economy and creating a state where businesses want to come and people want to move because it has a reputation of strong education system, good jobs, and a clean environment, Busby says. But what we're seeing in the past few years, and it seems to be accelerating, is that we're moving back to the old paradigm of jobs versus the environment, he says, and that's really not how the world works. And now we have the nonprofit news. David and Connie Freeman of Chapel Hill have given $100,000 for the creation of the Priscilla Freeman Endowment to honor the memory of their daughter, who died in 1976 of meningococcemia at the age of 18. The endowment will be used to help support youth programs offered through the North Carolina Psychoanalytic Foundation. David Freeman is a retired child psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and founder of the North Carolina Psychoanalytic Foundation. Connie Freeman is a retired social worker. Federal employees of the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park have contributed more than $115,000 to local, national, and international charitable organizations. NIEHS Deputy Budget Analyst Scott Redman, who lives in Cary, helped lead the NIEHS efforts. "The CFC effort sends a very positive message about how much federal employees care. We do everything we can to support the communities where we live," he said. The North Carolina Retail Merchants Association is donating more than $81,000 in cash, $100,000 of in-kind donations, and $9,500 in gift cards to the North Carolina Association of Feeding America's Food Banks. The donations come from member organizations of NCRMA, including Sheetz, Harris Teeter, and Walgreens, among others. And now the People on the Move section. This by Lee Weisbecker. After tightening the financial reporting rules governing state-supported nonprofits last year, lawmakers are at it again with another oversight proposal. This time, they want to know whether the state is getting a bang for its buck. And that seems to be a misprint. This is a previous article we've already written that's in this People on the Move section, so we'll stop there. And now we turn to the healthcare section, written by Jason DeBrun in the Triangle Business Journal. This first article has the headline, "Keep Up, Duke Wants to Add Bypass Machines." And this has a dateline of Durham. The Duke University Health System is asking regulators for permission to add two heart-lung bypass machines at a capital investment of $445,000. Bypass equipment is used during various surgical procedures, and its use is not billed separately to patients. Duke has seven such machines that operated at 100% of practical capacity last year, according to the healthcare system. To be even more precise, the machines were utilized for 891,448 minutes, according to hospital data, or the equivalent of an average of 2,122 hours per year per machine. When considering population growth, Duke projects that 1,751 patients will require the use of these machines per year. Traditional heart surgery, often called open heart surgery, is done by opening the chest wall to operate on the heart, according to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. Once the heart is exposed, the patient is connected to a heart-lung bypass machine. The machine takes over the heart's pumping action and moves blood away from the heart. This allows the surgeon to operate on a heart that isn't beating and that doesn't have blood flowing through it, the Institute's experts explain. Especially when the new Duke Medical Pavilion opens in July, Duke says the operational challenges in ensuring adequate bypass availability will increase. Duke made the application to buy the machines with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, which will review the request. For the fiscal year 2012, which ended on June 30 of that year, the Duke University Health System reported $2.3 billion of patient revenue and an operating income of $238 million. The system projects revenue to increase steadily to $2.8 billion by 2017, but forecasts income to steadily decline to $72 million by 2017. And now we turn to the technology section, written by Lauren Onsorge. The first headline, Profs Lighting, Is It a Threat to Cree? Field-Induced Polymer Electroluminescent, FIPEL, could this be the technology that topples LED? A Wake Forest University scientist who developed the new lighting technology says FIPEL is about to make an impact. But will it create a big enough crater to attract the ire of Durham-based LED giant Cree? Maybe, say scientists. Maybe not, say analysts. It could actually change the lighting world, period. No ifs, ands, or buts, says Richard Caruso, CEO of C-Light, a Colmar, Pennsylvania company that hopes to start manufacturing lighting using the FIPEL technology as early as 2014. He says it's about the versatility of the science and the cost structure, both of which he credits to FIPEL's inventor, David Carroll, director for the Center of Nanotechnology and Molecular Materials at Wake Forest University. Carroll uses three layers of moldable white-emitting polymer blended with nanomaterials that glow to create a lighting effect. Pretty much every type of light except for fluorescent, you have a current that's flowing, Carroll explains. You hook it up to a battery and the current flows through the thing. There's no current flowing through this. Carroll says the lights are twice as efficient as CFLs and similar to LEDs in efficiency. But the aspect that has him smiling? The cost. LEDs cost about $25 per kilo lumen, he says. FIPEL technology, $2.96 per kilo lumen. Wedbush analyst Craig Irwin agrees there's much buzz, but he approaches FIPEL with just as much skepticism. In my experience, the bigger the claims, the louder the claims, the more likely they are to be raising money at the same time, he says. I'm not saying they're not going to be successful, I'm just saying, let's be really careful. Carroll says he's not out to grab Cree's market share, but rather to create better lighting. Worldwide, the market for lighting spaces in your home is $4 billion, he says. Surely there's enough room for C-Light and Cree, he says. And in the quick take section, Dennis Walsh, recently promoted to president of Redwood Americas and Asia Pacific for Redwood Software, is evangelical about the cloud. It doesn't matter whether you're a consumer or a business, the cloud is here and it's here to stay. One of the things that over the past 20 years that's kept us in business and kept us growing is we've always been at the forefront. The cloud is one mode of delivery mechanism, if you will, that we are utilizing to get our solutions out to our customers. So why isn't everybody on the cloud? If you go through the history of technology, you have early adopters, and businesses by nature are conservatively run. Why? Because they are in the business of making money, and taking some crazy jump on new technology isn't for everybody. The cloud is relatively new, and for some conservative companies, it's not for them. They may not understand it. It might scare them. They may not be ready for it yet. That will change over time. Redwood, an automation software company with 30 employees in Morrisville, is currently hiring. And in the perspective section, Quintiles is a different proposition than other companies filing to go public over the next few months, says Daniel Sweet, an analyst for IPO Boutique. Quintiles is owned primarily by three investors, its founder, Dennis Gillings, Mitt Romney's former employer, Bain Capital, and TPG Funds. Together, the three own about 70% of the Durham company. Private equity deals can work very successfully, Sweet notes, or they can be very laden with debt, but the financials here look pretty healthy. He points to a few key differences between Quintiles and other biotech, biopharma-style companies. It is a very mature company, he says. It has very mature revenues. It has very mature revenue growth. It is in a much more mature state and is a much larger company than the general startup biopharma company that we have been seeing over the past 2 months. That is definitely going to work in its favor. And in the Spotlight section in the Triangle Business Journal, the spotlight is on Wake Forest, with an article written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Wake Forest. The headline, Wake Forest Fashions New Plan to Guide Town's Future. Planners in Wake Forest are wrapping up the final version of the town's first unified development ordinance that in the future will dictate all zoning, subdivision, land use, and development proposals for the fast-growing municipality. A public hearing is scheduled for April, and the Wake Forest Board of Commissioners is expected to vote on adoption of the plan in the summer, says Chad Sari, Assistant Planning Director for Wake Forest. We've spent the last 3 years working on this, Sari says. It's been a good learning experience. Sari says the UDO will incorporate all of the ordinance rules that the town has adopted over the years to regulate zoning, subdivisions, stormwater management, and other property development plans, while also clarifying inconsistencies and taking out redundancies. Creation of the UDO, Sari says, was one of the key strategies needed for the town to implement the Wake Forest Community Plan that was adopted in 2009. Sari says the old codes would not have allowed many of the developments that the community plan envisioned. One such project is the Renaissance Place project that MI Homes wants to develop on South Brook Street near Town Hall. MI Homes submitted a subdivision master plan in January that shows 105 townhouse units, including several live-work units that allow small merchants to work downstairs and live upstairs. It is near the Renaissance Place retail building that has recently redeveloped and reopened with the Brook Street Bowling Alley and the Over the Falls restaurant. This is our first real urban-style townhouse development in downtown, Sari says of MI Homes Renaissance Place. It's still sort of new to us, so we're still figuring it out. Sari says the slowdown in new development projects in the town over the past 3 years has allowed the planning staff and its consultants to concentrate on creation of the UDO, but he adds that he is starting to see an uptick in real estate investment in Wake Forest. In the past 2 years, he says, development plans for five new apartment communities have been filed with the planning department, and they are collectively expected to add more than 1,500 apartment units to the town's rental inventory. And below that article, we have a question and answer section with Andy Ammons, president of Ammons Development Group. It has been 13 years since construction started on what would become the 2,500-acre Heritage Community in Wake Forest, a project that has since created homes for more than 2,500 families. As Heritage enters its final stage of construction, Triangle Business Journal real estate reporter Amanda Jones Hoyle talks with Andy Ammons, president of Ammons Development Group, about what happens next. Was the original plan for Heritage always this large? The original master plan was for 1,300 homes on 900 acres, with much of the related retail, schools, amenities that we have today. We have purchased additional land on several occasions so that Heritage will probably have over 2,500 homes on approximately 1,800 acres when complete. The amenity areas, retail, and office areas have also increased by about 30% with this additional land. How important was it that Heritage have sites for its own elementary school, middle school, and high school? One of the things that has made Heritage successful is that we are a complete master planned community that includes a great education component. In addition to the three public schools you've mentioned, we also have incorporated a private school, Thales Academy, five separate preschool and daycare facilities, and are adjacent to a fourth public school, Wake Forest Roseville Middle School, and a charter school, Franklin Academy. What steps have you taken to keep the building and sales momentum going at Heritage through the years? In 1998, we knew what we wanted to accomplish. I had given disposable cameras to about 30 real estate agents and told them to take pictures of what they viewed as small town America. What they came back with was basic stuff: sidewalks, street signs, paint colors. We took those ideas and incorporated them into our plans, and we've never varied from that. Plus, we have focus groups about every other year that tell us how we're doing and what should be changed. How was Heritage most affected by the housing market crash in 2008, and how did your strategy for Heritage's growth have to change? When things were really good in 2004 and 2005, we didn't get greedy, so we didn't get things really out of whack. When we first recognized that things were not going to be normal in 2007, we redesigned all of our plans. We reduced the 3,000-square-foot home to 2,800 square feet. As a result, our homes never lost the value that some other communities had. What projects are next for Ammons Development Group? We do own substantial land tracts, both adjacent to Heritage and within a few miles. I've got a lot of other investments that we've made and that we'll be with for many more years. We still own about 200 acres that's south of Heritage, and we still have 700 acres at the Traditions at Heritage community that's already been approved and is already under development. I'm not sure I'll be as hands-on during the day-to-day process as I have been at Heritage, but I'll be involved. And now we'll read the small business profile in this issue of the Triangle Business Journal. It's concerning a company called Feel Goods, F-E-E-L-G-O-O-D-Z. The headline on the article, merging their companies, these flip-flops are made for selling. And this is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. When two small flip-flop companies joined forces, things clicked right away. Still, even some of the more optimistic projections didn't forecast the kind of early success that has happened. Now, footwear company Feel Goods offers more than just sandals and is picking its way through a maze to grow from a startup into a real business. It's both scary and exciting, says Mark Saad, the company's chief financial officer. Saad started Kinder Souls in the Triangle and made flip-flops out of recycled materials such as plastic water bottles. He was named a Triangle Business Journal 40 Under 40 Award recipient in 2011, but at about $40,000 a year, his sales were small. In New Orleans, Kyle Berner operated Feel Goods and was making his own eco-friendly footwear. He generated about $400,000 in 2011. The companies merged in early 2012 and recorded a combined revenue just shy of $800,000 last year. They are now projecting revenue in the $1.8 million range for 2013, and Berner has said he wants to add hit $50 million by 2020. Feel Goods prides itself on the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit, and works with co-op farms in Vietnam to harvest rubber the company buys at fair market value, and ensures the harvesters receive a fair wage. The same holds true for processing and manufacturing, says Saad and Berner. The footwear is then transported to a new distribution facility in Garner. Until recently, Feel Good shared a distribution facility in California, but with the growth, the partners decided to invest locally. In fact, Saad says he has been spending more of his time at the distribution facility and less at the storefront and design studio near the corner of Wilmington and Harget Streets. The new warehouse resulted in the hiring of 3 additional employees, but there again, Saad says that is as much scary as it is exciting. For years, he was the only one dependent on the success of his company, but now there are other employees who are looking to Feel Goods for steady employment. We're moving from a startup mentality to a real business, he says. In other areas, Feel Goods partners have tried to buy locally whenever possible. They contracted with Atlantic BT, headquartered on Creedmoor Road in Raleigh, for a website redesign and software upgrades, and with Lot Design near Briar Creek for some of the design needs. They even worked with Lot to use plywood that was harvested from trees around the Triangle, Saad says. As they continue to build Feel Goods into a full-fledged company, Saad and Berner say they still have a long way to go, but they have their sights set on growing from a flip-flop startup to a footwear powerhouse. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read from TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Garner getting 50 new jobs with UltraPure. The UltraPure Systems Incorporated facility that is opening in Garner's Greenfield North Business Park is expected to create 50 new jobs in its first year of operation. Most of the positions will be for engineers and skilled laborers, according to a news release from the Garner's Economic Development Director, Tony Beasley, who has been in contact with UltraPure President and CEO Cesar Roca. Roca has told town officials that the Garner facility will become the North American headquarters for UltraPure Systems, and it will likely also become the firm's engineering center, where engineers will serve clients globally. UltraPure will invest about $500,000 in the 12,000-square-foot facility in Garner, which is expected to open April 1, Roca says. Red Hat pumping up its data play. Raleigh-based open-source software company Red Hat has announced a new data direction with new products and new ways to deliver big data solutions to customers. It's not a surprise. According to the latest Linux Foundation Enterprise Linux User Report, the majority of big data implementations run on Linux, and as Red Hat is the leading provider of commercial Linux One, the company is increasingly looking at big data. And it's utilizing the cloud to up its game. The cloud makes it easier to store, aggregate, normalize, and integrate data from sources across multiple platforms, whether they are deployed as physical, virtual, or cloud-based resources. First Citizens brings facilities chief on board. Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank, which works to give its physical footprint a distinctive look, has hired a new manager of corporate real estate. Kirk Duncan will be responsible for the design and development of the bank's facilities, including its branches and office network. That network, now in 17 states and the District of Columbia, includes 418 branch offices, of which 264 are located in North Carolina. Next comes Virginia with 47 offices, California with 29, and Florida with 17. United Healthcare to add 600 new jobs in North Carolina. Health insurance provider United Healthcare announced it would add 600 new jobs in North Carolina, bringing its total workforce here to more than 4,700 when fully expanded. Part of United Health Group Incorporated, the jobs will be mostly through the United Healthcare and Optum business segments. The positions will be filled mostly in Greensboro and include customer service representatives, claims processors, nurses, and clinicians. The jobs are in United Healthcare's health benefits business and Optum's health service division. Jay Parker to lead Lenovo North America. Lenovo Group Limited, which has its North American headquarters in Morrisville, has announced a new president for its North American operations. Jay Parker is being promoted from his position as vice president and general manager of Lenovo's North America Consumer and Small Medium Business Unit. Earlier this month, the company announced a new Americas division that would bring Latin American markets into those overseen by Jerry Smith. And we'll stop there. As we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.